So I really actually do want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Pleasure.
And also for your talk yesterday, which we, as promised, was very provocative and really interesting. I remember when I first saw you speak a couple years ago, I left and ran away to sort of discover an entirely new bibliography of my life. And so it was nice to sort of see where you've gone since then with a similar bibliography, though Great Lakes Man. And also, I think, talking to some of the students afterwards and some of the professors, I think there were some similar reactions, certain sort of nexus mm-hmm. of that. So I thought, you know, given that you've just published a new book with a major French text, a major French press, mm-hmm. And given that you know, other book is now 10 years old, a certain other major book also with MIT, right, Leonardo. I thought maybe it'd just be good to sort of start with, it's kind of a general question, but you're one of the thinkers who has adopted the word inhuman mm-hmm. rather than post-human.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could maybe just talk a bit about the way you differentiate those terms or whether they're interchangeable.
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, in the environment we're in, there's so many words and there's so many shuffling of people are moving to try to get to the front, right? It's a little difficult to get to the front with an idea today. So, and also I think that's one of the reasons, so this is it's not very gracious, but that's one of the reasons, get to the forefront with some sort of a provocative idea. The two other reasons are to provoke, mm-hmm. force people to think about things, and also because I think the post prefix has been used too much, right? It doesn't mean anything. It just becomes by itself, it's so passé by itself, right?
Sure.
So people will tend to get away from it just because you're using the post, and also because as a writer and as a thinker, you need something that triggers your curiosity, right? And it forces you to say, well, okay, I'm using this inhuman, which in the general acceptance of things doesn't mean what I want it to mean, right? It means cruel and dangerous and something we want to avoid, right?
Right.
And I want it to mean one of its definitions in the dictionary, meaning other than human. And then it forces me also to explain what I'm trying to do. So, it sort of backs you up, backs you in a corner, and it forces you to engage people, engage yourself into trying to explain it instead of using something that's been used and used and reused and where you feel you're just, you're just walking into known terrain. So here you're walking into unknowns and it's kind of exciting. And it also, again, forces people to because the goal of the book is really to force readers to see that some of the things we've been using so far do not work anymore.
Right.
Right? And it needs more than they post. It needs more than a hyper. It needs something else. So it was the question of trying to find something else, but it was difficult.
Right.
So that was a reason. There is also the third, the last reason is also because it echoes the human condition from that whole, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that a French readership would understand that, right?
Right?
People caught up on that. So it was this idea also of echoing, Malraux's The Human Conditions about the 1950s, about 50 years later, echoing that and trying to work within that.
Right. So do you think, somebody like Hales in the kind of big book that sort of brought post-humanism,
mm-hmm.
I think, really to the
yeah.
academy, or at least
mm-hmm.
to certain
mm-hmm.
sections of the academy, she says we've always been post-human.
Yeah.
And that sort of resonates with the idea of an inhuman, where there's a different temporality at play, would you say?
I don't know if it's temporality, but it's something about, again, I think, it's a sort of a mosaic or cosmology or, sort of a group of people thinking within the same lines, right? So Catherine Hales is thinking within one set of things, Sloterdijk is thinking into another set of things.
Right.
And of course, ideas move between all of these people, and myself included, and we borrow and we change. So I think I'm not sure if it's temporality as much as people realizing that there's something that doesn't work about our perception of humanity.
Right.
So for some people, and I think you can go back all the way to maybe the 19th century or even Les Lumières, right? Even the materialists, La Mettrie and other people said, what is the human body here, right? Is it a machine? Is it not a machine? So it was this feeling that something about our definition of humanity didn't work. And I was mentioning yesterday the difference, I think, between philosopher of the last 2,000 years and people now is science is telling us that some of the intuitions we had seem to be true, because there is something that doesn't work about our definition. And I think everyone is trying to put a break into this wall to understand where we're going. So we're all trying a little bit to sort of a circumscribe this new human. So on the one hand, you have the post-human, the Catherine Hales, and people are more theoretically oriented. Then you also have people who are either utopian or dystopian, so the Ray Kurzweil, for example, or the Bill Joy, who wrote this article in Wired a few years back, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. So you have the, and also most of the Europeans, which are, you know, are closely aligned to the dystopian vision. And then you have people who say, yeah, we should become post-human, like the transhumans.
Yeah.
You had all of these people together. And within that, well, I think you also have people who are saying, is our political system the right one? Is democracy the right thing? Is fundamentalism the right thing? And all of these things are they're within this sort of the, you know, ecosystem of ideas. And everyone is trying. But I think the general feeling is that something doesn't fit anymore. And my point of view is that machines have forced us they've forced us to look at things differently, but as they've also forced us into another world, a world where men and machines work together, and we haven't built our world with that in mind.
Right. And so in that that different world, I there's a slightly different tenor to that. You know, in Metal and Flesh, you're talking about cultural bodies, and the way that relation sort of multiplies and begins to detach from genetics. And then I was reading the other day the Ars Electronica article that was published there, and you sort of re-emphasize this hybrid reality, right? And in the inhuman condition, in this connection to the human connection condition, and then also we were talking briefly after your talk about fundamentalism, I'm sensing this very much this twinned notion,
right?
And so is there a sense in which these are also again human questions and become more fundamentally human as they become more fundamentally technology? Is there a shift that's happening there, or is this
are you saying that because in reaction to this shift we're pushing towards a more strict definition of humanity,
or is there, do these questions In a book, what struck me about Metal and Flesh was that the questions become then, that arise about our existence, become questions of mechanisms, become questions of determination in a certain sense, right? And yet, there's a kind of politics too, right? Which strike me as human questions, quintessentially human questions in some ways. Do you see those as mutually exclusive or entangled?
That's the you know, that's a million-dollar question here. You know, it's hard to perceive this thing either separately or together. It's sort of a paradox here, right?
Right.
Because at one point, your mind—that's my perception of things. When you're thinking about processes, your mind has to, at one point, make it clear. You gotta have you have to visualize what you're trying to say. You have to understand some of the processes and say, okay, this is how it works, and this is how it works, and this is sort of the scientific method, right? You look at things, you have a hypothesis, you look at things, and you're trying to see if this works. Now, this is the laboratory setting, where everything is nice and everything, you know, you can control everything. Now, reality, and this is in your mind, you need some of that. Reality is not that clear, right? Everything is contaminated, everything is infected, everything is transformed by something else. So, on the one hand, and you're right, on the one hand, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, and they're mutually inclusive. However, to be able to think about these things, at one point you got to extract some of this uneasiness, some of this contamination, right? To sort of look at the processes and say, okay, this is how the structure seems to work. On the other hand, it is always transformed by the world that is around it,
right?
So, because if you don't at one point try to separate those things, what happens is that you become Deleuze. And it's very interesting, because it reflects some of the richness and uneasiness of life, but it's almost impossible to read. truly, right? Mm-hmm. It's extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And out of Deleuze, you will get a feeling of rhizomes, for example. You will get a feeling of things that are uneasy, they move in all directions, and that is close to what to how life works, right? But at one point, if you want to think clearly about life, you also need a more scientific approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read, what was the book by the scientist who criticized the philosophers?
Sokal.
If you read Sokal, I think that's exactly the problem. On the one hand, you have all these mostly French philosophers, right? Deleuze and others, who were thinking about science and nature and human beings and all this rich and complicated and metaphorical way, which is interesting because that's in a way how life is.
Mm-hmm.
But they were using things a little too freely. And then on the other hand, you have the scientists who say, well, okay, this is all good and well, but this is not how you should be using these things, right?
Right,
you can use them metaphorically, but this is not science. And I think this is the problem we're all facing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to reflect this richness, and then it's almost impossible to think with? Or do you want to reflect the processes, and at that point you need to be able to use a sort of a scientific method, but you get rid of this uneasiness of life that is present in it anyway.
Hmm. Is that a question of materiality then, do you think? Is that a question of where and how materiality is defined? Is that the...
I think I'm a, you know, I don't think that's a secret. I think I'm a profoundly materialist person, right?
Yeah.
I strongly believe that. However, I do think that it seems, and I was mentioning it yesterday, it seems that there is materiality, material world is not only what we see. There's something that seems strange about it, right?
Uh-huh.
And again, the example I was giving yesterday is emergence, right? So emergence is saying that you get units, but the sum of the units is more than the total of the units, right? Together, they're more than their total.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you used to take the example of ants, for example, and each ant is not extremely intelligent, and the total of these ants together is not great, but the sum, somehow, of this all these together is much more than the ants mm-hmm. together, right? So we don't know how this works.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will say the brain works, and say, well, neurons. And we say, well, then there is emergence. So again, as I was saying yesterday, this is like alchemy or magic, right? We don't know, so we say, well, you know, that suddenly something emerges. But what it says, I think, is that there is maybe those are algorithms, maybe those are ways that nature works, but there's something missing that enables the material world to go into high complexities.
Mm-hmm.
And these high complexities, maybe they give rise to things like consciousness, maybe. Maybe they give rise to things like a sort of a intelligence within nature or within collective. So I think the difference between myself and maybe materialists of, you know, earlier centuries,
mm-hmm.
previous centuries, was I think there is, and I'm not, of course, the only one saying that, but there is complexity in matter that's beyond matter in a way.
Mm-hmm.
What it is, we don't know, right? And I think if you look, for example, at a very good example of this problem with the material world is quantum physics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we know that quantum physics is strange, right? You look at a photon and it becomes something else because you're looking at it. You're not looking, right? But something is looking at it,
right?
And we don't know what it is. So we invent all of these things and it sort of works, but if you look at quantum physics, how it is explained, there is some sort of magic there, right? There's something like black or white magic. It's a little so strange, but what it says is that the material world has dimensions or aspects to it that is very, very complex, or at least beyond our comprehension, and these things will give rise to other states.
Right.
And I think this link there is not me. But again, at heart, I believe in the material world.
And yeah.
I believe in mechanisms in the material world at heart.
I'm so glad, actually, that you raised emergence, because I actually had two questions related to how that idea is sort of moving in your thought. And one is, it strikes me, and I'm not the first to be struck this way, that emergence actually, in the language of simultaneity and complexity,
mm-hmm.
Poses a real challenge to semiotics, right, to the notion of
yeah.
representation.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, that the language of material science, even at its most abstract, is dependent on a language of semiotics? Is that something where, and so I really appreciate in your writing the movement to try to move away from a kind of determination that somebody like Baudrillard, right, is ultimately ending up in, at least early Baudrillard in the simulations. But what is the sort of nuanced relationship between semiotics after emergence comes into discourse?
To be real honest with you, I'm not enough of an expert to say things that I think are interesting this topic, because it's a whole topic. Be semiotician or semiologist, it's a whole topic, and there's a whole science to signs that I'm not. No, I touch on it very briefly and quickly, but not enough to go into that. Do I think what you want me to go into? Because I'm afraid I'm going to say things that really don't make sense.
So sure.
Yeah. Maybe if we can rephrase that.
Yeah. Well, actually, Emil raised the question of capital, which is
I think interesting. The way I see the last 200 years is that there have been a series of ideas that have destabilized humanity. And I think what you describe in La Condition Inhumaine does a good job in showing how science, especially sort of Dawkins's thought, destabilizes what is human. But I mean, it starts with Darwin, who basically tells us that we're not what we thought we were. But there's also Freud, followed by Lacan, and
even Einstein.
That's right, Einstein. So there's a series, and deconstruction, Heidegger, a series of new ideas, and that's pretty much what the last 200 years of intellectual history have shown us, is that this is, and so we're at the tail end of that, and or at the beginning of it, you know, at the tail end of that kind of tradition, though, and it does seem that your work takes a departure from the continental European, it's, you don't mention Heidegger. Especially on technology, you don't mention Hannah Arendt, who's interesting because the human condition is one of her titles. But one thing that I found interesting is the presence of Marx, and Marxism or that sort of historical materialism presents an interesting view of humanity and human history, and in some ways would suggest that all the other destabilizations of humanity are subordinate to the sort of materiality or this economic determinism proposed by Marx. I don't know if you have how exactly you see the role of capitalism in describing this relationship between the human and the technological. Maybe I can elaborate a little more, but I think that in some ways the Marxists would say that actually these relationships are determined by economics.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you would...
I think the battle the battle between the Marxist view of the world and the capitalist view of the world, was also echoed within all sorts of different systems, the 20th century fascism and then Nazism and all of these things. I think they felt that they were systems, right? And actually, Marx is explaining the system pretty well. But my only problem with his perception, well, there's a few of them, of course, but one of them is I think the human element is too strong in it. I think my perception is that these things are much stronger than we are, and we actually are only expressions of these systems. And I'm not sure if these systems, again, because he's putting these systems on a value scale, right? Good and bad, and evil and not evil. And we need these things to live as human beings, and capitalism does the same, and socialism does the same, right? And this is what I was saying yesterday. We've got to get away from these, to me, simplified view of how things are going, even though people do suffer, right? I'm not denying this. But I think we got to go beyond these things and maybe see that these systems are essentially things that push us into behaving in a certain way. And I think what's interesting about Marxism is that Marx was able, and he seems to be, you know, and of course Marxism and Darwinism had, you know, were intertwined by a lot of people through the, you know, from the 19th century on, right? But I think there's something there also. There's something about a relationship between predators and prey and the state of equilibrium and of the forces of market that capitalist wants us to just use all the time. So all of these things, of course, are perverted by human intentions and agendas and people wanting, but there's something true about these things. There's something true about this relationship between the have and the have-nots and the perception of power between things. And what we realize, I think, what was missing from Marxism, for example, is science and especially ethology, right? The science of the behavior of animals. And when you look at the behavior of animals, it's strikingly, you know, surprising, because you see things that are very close to the way we do things. And then it makes you wonder, are we creating those systems because we are essentially guided by desire and greed, or are we just responding to things that are within nature? And that's my fundamental question. How I would see Marxism, and that's why I don't talk about these systems too much, is because they're imprisoned into a history of the 20th, the 19th, and the 20th century, and they're imprisoned into a history that said that whenever you talk about one or the other, you're in one camp or another, and this one camp has a long history, some of it good and some of it bad, most of it bad for both camps, and you can't get out of these things. Right. So I wanted to get out of these polarizations, essentially. That's why I went into science and tried to look at things a little differently. Now, again, I recognize that, as I was mentioned yesterday, there's no scientific discourse. There's no, even my discourse, there's no sociological discourse that's free of any, you know, cultural training, agenda, socioeconomic position. I'm saying these things also because I am someone who's got a good salary in a, you know, in a democratic society and feel comfortable about the way he lives, right? I may have said something else if I was, you know, an intellectual in the third world, and I recognize that too. But I think science is also saying, well, this is a different perspective of how you can look at things. All of these things that came before are interesting and we should use them, but let's look at them a little bit differently. So again, you mentioned Heidegger and his relationship to technology. Some of the things he said in his famous text on technology is extremely interesting, and you know, you can still apply it today. But again, it goes into a system that places values to it and morals to it, right? And the good and the bad and the evil and a romantic vision of society and a very prescriptive and dystopian vision of technology. Which in a way is true, technology is changing the world. But I wanted to look at, are these things really human intentions, or are they system, and are they planetary systems that we fall into? And I think in my new book, I'm trying to define in human condition, because I'm saying we have to think differently now. You know, I gotta put up with what I'm saying also, right? So I'm trying to define this, and I'm saying more and more that I believe more and more that those are systems that work beyond us. And they actually work beyond, that's what my new book is saying, they actually work beyond the organic nature of the world. They go into replication, which goes back to our cultural bodies. Mm-hmm. We're into systems that do not really care about organic matter. They do not really care about organic life. Again, to say that do not really care, I'm giving attention to these things, but it's hard to go beyond language, right? But I think we're into systems that just trying to replicate and multiply. And I do believe we're going into a system that will have less emphasis on organic life and more emphasis on another type of life.
It's so interesting because, you know, before your talk yesterday, I've been reading some of your work as a deconstruction of mm-hmm. science, actually. Mm-hmm. And so when Lincoln, you know, mentioned this discursive status of science as also having its own values, mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, of course. Right? Mm-hmm. But amidst really lots of positive and wonderful reviews of Metal and Flesh was this one really scathing one from Murkowski. I don't know if you
I have more than one.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, this, you know, this guy from Notre Dame, he's a scientist, right? And the accusation was, well, you know, there's slippage happening here between the science and the cultural analysis. And I thought, boy, what a profoundly way to miss the point, right? Because it struck me that the work you're doing is exactly in that slippage, right? It's feeding that slippage back onto science. But then it still strikes me that there's this incommensurability between that response, right, between that sort of metaphorics and this materiality and these definitions of life, right? And so I guess the question I have about that, because I recognize in a sense that incommensurability can't be overcome in language, right? But I'm really curious as to if you have sort of a specific idea of, we'll call that a hauntology, a specific idea of what that is, beyond simply fundamentalism. Is there a value system of science that is really locatable, or is that part of the project to begin to locate these values?
I think that, you know, it goes back to what I was saying about the uneasiness and the complexity of human nature, right? I think it is, at the same point, locatable and unlocatable, right? You can locate it, and the closer you get to it, the more it moves and it slips away from you. Again, a little bit like quantum physics. You look at something and it changes, because you're looking at it, it changes its nature. Mm-hmm. And I think that's essential about human beings. The more we look at things, the more things tend to change their nature because we're looking at them. And also because we're looking at them, but then also, that's also another part of slippage. Because we're looking at him with a brain that has a certain capacity of looking at things, right? To me, the most interesting feedback loop is that we're looking at the world, and specifically at the brain, because when we look at the world, we look at, I think, essentially at three things. We look at language, intelligence, consciousness. Everything is pretty much based on these things, right? What is intelligence? What is consciousness? God? You can go all the way down. What is intelligence? All the way down and all the way up. And what is language, right? It's been a question, philosophers have asked the question of what is human nature for the last 2,000 years, but it's always through language and intelligence and consciousness. And I think all of these things, the interesting part that they exist, the limit to everything we do is that we look at these things while using them to look at these things, right? So to make a stupid analogy, it's trying to decipher what a fork would be using a fork to analyze it, right? So at one point you're very limited.
Right.
And I think language and consciousness and human culture and human agenda, human discourse, you look at human discourse with discourse. So at one point, things will slip. And I think we're all caught into that. And it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, that the only way to get out of that, well, there's two ways. You can plunge into it like Deleuze, right? And just, you know, celebrate this disappearance of nature while you're getting close to it.
Yeah.
Or you can say, I'll try to do a scientific method and get rid of the in controllable things you can't control and look at simulation. But the simulations are, you know, they're not really true because they don't take into account the slippage. So, you know, to answer your question, I think it's discourse is there and you can't get rid of it.
Right.
And just saying that you're trying to look at discourse, it's discourse already, right? So, and even, I would say even worse than that, or even more difficult than that, it's looking at discourse of science, or discourse on culture, or discourse on all of these things, while using a specific language, you know? If you look at discourse using French or English, it's different. If you use German, it's different. If you use computer language, it's different.
Right.
But they keep moving away from you.
Right.
And, you know, when I realized that, I said, there's not much more I can do about this.
Right.
Just to give you another example, I was reading a few years back a book on the relationship between scientists, well-known scientists, and their religious beliefs. And talking about, you know, great scientists here.
Yeah.
And the only way these people could bring these two together is by not making them meet each other, right? So like they had two personalities. One was their scientific personality, the other was their religious personality, and these two would not meet, right? They had two brains, these two would not meet, because they knew they could not bring them together.
Right.
So I think that's the solution,
right?
Is that either you make sure that these things are separated, and then you can try to analyze them, knowing that you're losing something on it when you analyze it out this way, because you're not talking about the discourse and all of these things. Or you talk about, you bring these two together, like Deleuze, like, you know, people, religious people, and then you're caught in all sorts of things that are difficult to actually understand because they're much too complex for our brain.
Right. That actually reminds me, I was reading just last night Chomsky's post 9/11 book, I don't know if you've read it, and he was talking about the Nuremberg trials and how that was when they defined a war crime, right? What a war crime was. And part of that definition was quite literally written in, if they did it and we didn't. And so, and so part of the defense strategies of German submarine operators, what they would call as witnesses, they would call American submarine officers and say, look, they were doing the same thing. And that would be a sort of active defense, and they were establishing what was sort of beyond the pale and what was not, you know, quite literally. So it strikes me as a, you know, that's exactly that kind of confluence that you're talking about, right, in the values. But before that last anecdote, what I heard you saying was, in a sense, if we wanted to pinpoint the politics of science, it would be something along the lines of registration or meaning.
What exactly do you mean by registration or meaning?
The ability to say that for all intents and purposes in this instance, you know, X is X, and that has a meaning that even if we can't identify the specific definition of it, we can understand the form that it gives me.
But that's the goal of science, right? I think that's what differentiates science. Essentially, that's my point of view. That's what differentiates science from philosophy.
Right.
It does try to have some sort of a proof in material, right? Material proof that can be reproduced and replicated, data. Now again, you can't, data is also caught into discourse, of course, but there is something in data that's beyond discourse a little bit, right? It moves away from it, not completely, not totally, and not the way we would like it, but it moves away a little bit from it, meaning that, and the proof of the matter is that, you know, you can have a scientific experiment and you can reproduce this experiment, notwithstanding your culture, your language, right, or your sex, right? You can reproduce. Again, then there's discourse within this own language, but it moves away a little bit from it. And again, the proof is that we're building things out of these things that seem to be a little bit more on the objective side of the world. Now, you know, that's not totally objective, of course not. It's not purity or the absolute, but it moves towards it a little bit more, because even though all of these things were built by languages, right? So science and technology and machines were built by languages, and they are essentially languages. They are also a little bit, they are able to be, they're a little bit freer from all sorts of biological impulses that we have, which are in language, right? The need to dominate or not be dominated, the need to impose yourself, and all of these things. And machines, even though they're built by languages, and even though that is inscribed within themselves because they're built by languages, they're a little bit freer from these things than we are. Mm-hmm. And I think they make us see things that we wouldn't be able to see because we're too caught up into our own biology.
Right.
So I think it moves a little bit closer to a sort of an absolute. And my point is that all of these inquiries we had in the last 2,000 years about the human condition, about humanity, about the, you know, shape, the moving shape of humanity, the impossibility to pinpoint culture and all of these things, well, actually science now, with machines a little bit more of an objective view of the world, is telling us, well, that is, you know, that is true, actually. There is a lot of that. But it's not only, you know, it's not only cognitive impressions and exercises. Some of the reality we're seeing seem to say that, yes, a lot of that is true. A lot of this is interesting. And I think, for example, I think the relationship between phenomenology and quantum physics is pretty amazing. Right? There is something about the observer and consciousness that creates the world, that quantum physics says there is something to that, right? Mm-hmm. Not exactly the way we perceive it, it's a little different, but there's a link there. So the idea, the original idea, was interesting. And I think that is what's interesting about science.
sort of traditional post-structuralist response would be something along the lines of, you know, science is offering the when if you take the perspective that science offers something that we can't see because of our sort of biological inhibitions, and say, well, actually, we can see them through our biological inhibitions, but science enters them into language, right? And so, what I understand you're saying is there's actually, and what I think would be sort of in line with a lot of the sort of, it might be a common thing across many thinkers around inhumanism and posthumanism, would be that actually there are multiple realities that intersect and are entangled, to use the word you use, but also have their own worlds under themselves, and their own sense in which they've worlds under themselves. So just to shift gears a little bit, could you maybe, through that lens, talk a little bit about this difference between genes and memes and what that's up to sort of in your thoughts these days?
Well, you know, as you know, we broached the subject yesterday, and I'm going to mention it tomorrow in the conference. Okay, first of all, do you want me to explain what it means?
Please do, yeah.
Okay, so that comes, the history of this thing is that it was created by Richard Dawkins. The term was invented by Richard Dawkins in his 1926 book, The Selfish Gene. And it's a small chapter towards the end of the book where he talks about cultural replicators. So how Dawkins sees things is that he sees that the world is not based on genes or anything, but on replicators, which are mechanisms that whose only objective is to replicate, to multiply. So he sees that genes are replicators, and actually he's a much more materialist than I am, right? And he sees that everything that we do is based on this ability or non-ability or desire to multiply our own replicators, right? And he goes as far as saying that human beings are survival machines for replicators, which are genes, right? So, and of course he's
provokes.
Yeah, he provokes a lot, right? And it's part of what he does. But some of what he said, again, as I was saying yesterday, has proven to be sort of true, right? Mm-hmm. So some of the relationship we have with people we love and like are oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes linked to how many genes we share with these people, right? Which is quite troubling when you think about it, right? Now, a lot of the things we do can also be explained by this ability or non-ability to disseminate our own material replicators. So even though he probably goes too far, he opened up a perception of the world that is very interesting, is that the essence of this world is nothing else but to multiply. And everything else is an aside,
right?
Or everything else is depending on that or an aside to that, right? But that's the only way. And you can even go as far as saying that art, and at one point somebody was mentioning, why are we doing art? Well, he says, well, art enables you to have a better status within society, and if you have a better status within society, well, you have more chances of, you know, having sexual relationship and multiplying your genes. Well, that's essentially the only reason why we're doing art, right?
Musicians know that.
Van Gogh's.
But you know, some of it is limited, but some of it seemed to be true. So now, to go back to that, so replicators are made either from genes or something else, and he says that his idea is that nature, but it's hard to define what a replicator is, but nature just looks at multiplying, and it can multiply within any matter. It can be organic matter or something else.
Right.
And this something else, he says, is also symbolic matter. So he says that he thinks that there's other replicators on this planet, and these other replicators are called memes. Memes come from the gene and from the French adverb meme, which means the same, right? So meme are like genes, they're replicators of ideas. So they multiply ideas. He actually calls them idea virus, right? So they're viruses, they multiply everywhere. They kidnap your multiplying mechanism, which is the brain, for a virtual, for an idea, which could be yourself or a real virus. The cell, you know, the virus gets into the cell and kidnaps the cell reproducing mechanism and has the cell multiplying viruses instead of something else. And he says the memes do the same thing with the brain. They multiply ideas in the brain. And he was never able to really define what memes are. He was never really able, which actually, I think, just an aside on this book. I think he had an idea at one point. He put it in the chapter of his book, and strangely enough, the self-hygiene idea worked well, and but this idea just exploded. It became a real meme itself, right? It became a virus, and it spread all over. And now I think it is in the dictionary. I think you can look in the dictionary. Meme is now accepted in the dictionary. And he was never able to define it, but everybody, again, has this intuition that there is something like the replication of ideas. There is something there, right? There is something about ideas getting into your brain and kidnapping your brain and stopping your brain from thinking about something else. And for example, he gives you know, anecdotal evidence of that, and some of it is quite interesting. Saying, for example, that some of the strongest memes are political ideology. And he says, for example, you cannot have two political ideology in your brain at the same time, because once it is infected by one, it can't be affected by the other, right? Because the brain is changed. So you can't be a Marxist and a capitalist at the same time. Even though the Chinese have tried that.
Well, there's also Jacques Attali.
Yes, you're right. But I mean, let's say, there are, let's say, a new form of these
two. Yeah, so it becomes a hybrid.
Yeah, it becomes a hybrid.
Or not even a hybrid. It just becomes something radically new.
Yeah, that's it. So, but have these two very different together, and religion is another, you know, it's another good idea about not having them together. And I think, and I mentioned it in Human Condition, in Life of Pi, for example, one of the great scenes at the beginning is this guy who's having all of these religions together, right? He's both Muslim and Jewish and Christian at the same time. And when he meets the priests, the imam or the rabbi, they say, you can't believe in all these religions at the same time. You got to choose one or the other. You can't be Muslim and Jewish at the same time. Yeah. It doesn't work, right? And I think there is something about this ideas shaping what we are, mm-hmm. and we transmit these ideas and we infect people with these ideas. So these are memes and genes. Now the only problem is that it's been tried to define these things. And then the problem is that you have to go from a materialist point of view, which Dawkins is, mm-hmm. to symbolism in the brain, which is very hard to pinpoint.
Right.
You know, they've been tried, people have tried it, and they say, well, a meme is a transformation in the structure of the brain. But even that seems a little...
Yeah.
So the problem with memes is that we're trying to find one.
Yeah.
We can't find one.
Right.
So can matter be symbolic?
No.
It's still quite the question is open.
That struck me yesterday. When you I thought it was a really brilliant point, you know, when you said talked about the fear that happened when people first started cloning, right? And mm-hmm. said, oh, you know, they're gonna make armies of clones, and you said, well, why would they when they can make a commercial and mobilize in the same way. And so I guess that's that perfect sort of slippage of materiality itself in a certain sense. Yeah.
Yes. But again, these things are usually, you know, it goes back to what we were saying previously. When you're talking about the slippage between material aspect of an idea or the immateriality of an idea, if you're using a scientific method, it doesn't really work, right?
Yeah.
And if you're using Deleuze style of writing, it works, but then it disappears into this richness of things, right?
Right.
And Deleuze is interesting again metaphorically, but is he giving any proof of things? Difficult, right? So again, you're in between these things, and again, it goes back to what we're saying about. To me, it's the same thing as emergence. There's a part of nature that we still don't understand, or we are not able to circumscribe or define. There's this part of it we're not. It's very complicated, and I think my position on this is that if we go beyond this perception of the human being as a unit that is intelligent and conscious, and is the individual with self-determination, if we go beyond that. Maybe we'll be able to look at this strand of nature that seems to be slipping away from our understanding. If we look into collective intelligences, if we look into our closeness to ants and insects, and if we look at how we are connected through viruses, maybe well that will open up some different ways of looking at the world.
And so is that what's at stake, do you think, in your writing then?
Yeah. And you know, sometimes when I have a graduate class and I, you know, show them all of these things, some students get actually pretty shocked, right? And some of them have problems with sleeping at night after all of this talk, right? And they keep telling me, how can you live this way, right? So, you know, I actually, myself, hope we'll get into that. But, of course, I don't live my life this way, right? I still believe in myself as a unique individual that is conscious and intelligent.
Right.
But the proof of what I'm looking at troubles me deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was mentioning that yesterday, and those are anecdotes, but anecdotes are sometimes interesting because they might not say the whole truth, but they point to something that seems to be happening. And I mentioned that yesterday, in 2000, I was reading the newspaper and they were saying, well, the Gen X are now 40 years old, right? And I was 37 at that time. And I'm exactly a Generation X person. And then they were saying, those are the characteristics of the Gen X, right? And those are the things they liked. And all of these things were exactly what I liked. All of the movies they were mentioning, I loved them. I was reading the books they were mentioning. I had the behaviors they were mentioning. I had done things that I was like, I felt myself as an individual. I'm doing exactly what my cohort of people all over, let's say, the Western world are doing.
Mm-hmm.
How strange is that?
Yeah.
Right? And that to me was a sort of an epiphany for me. It's like, I'm not above and beyond these systems. I'm part of these systems. How much self-determination I have, well, I think what I see as self-determination, I think there are two levels. On the general level, there's none. I truly believe there's none. And the example I'm giving in my new book is that, what is self-determination? Somebody can be reading the book and say, well, you know, I'm going to stop reading that book right now, right? And this is self-determination. Well, yes and no, because the great majority of people will do pretty much the same thing with the book, right? They'll either finish it or they'll stop it after 50 pages. I'm sure if we do a study on that, they'll stop it after 3 pages, 50 pages, 100 pages for the same reasons. Most people will have a series of possibilities in what they do, but this series of possibility is predictable. And I think there's very little self-determination in it. What self-determination would be is that if you have the book and you read it and you stop it, then you stop it for the same reasons.
Right.
Right? But how would you, actually the details of how you stop it, how the book would be placed on the table, the pages, all of these things are unpredictable. The minute details aren't predictable. The general ones, I think they're almost perfectly predictable. I don't think there's a lot of self-determination in human beings.
Yeah. And so someone who was trying to sort of recoup the human, I guess that's where they'd have to, you'd have somebody like Dussertto who's trying to narrate the everyday.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
To recuperate that.
Yeah. But even in the everyday, you get these two levels between the everyday normal.
Uh-huh.
And the everyday at the minute detail, right? Fine grained detail. Where there is, David is there, or Emil is there, or Lee is there. But the fact that we're all here talking about this thing, that we're in this room, books around us in the Institut Français in Victoria, that's extremely predictable.
Yeah.
It's extremely predictable.
Right.
It will happen eventually to the three of us, the four of us, right? It does happen, and it will happen, and all of these things are not. You know, they're not accident. They're extremely predictable because of the way we were raised, because of the education we have, because we belong to a collective,
mm-hmm.
and a collectivity, because all of these things that might not be exactly in the same room with exactly the same questions and exactly, you might not be sitting exactly the same way, but overall, that will happen and it's, you know, predictable. And that's why also people get into jobs because they know they have a predictable path and they like that path.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting though because you could... I wish I could remember a particular religious practice that talks about the exact same thing, but through a different comportment,
mm-hmm.
and saying, well, I mean, it shows up in a number of religions. It doesn't matter whether your job is, you know, to be a a neuroscientist, or to sweep the floors, or to to harvest rice. The religious comportment is to understand that repetitive action and that as fundamental, to treat yourself as human. And so, we started with this notion of twinning, right? In some sense, and I guess that's what it is, right? This is the kind of religious comportment to determination.
Maybe.
It's
very hard to accept.
Yeah.
It's extremely hard to accept that even my consciousness, which no one knows what it is, right? No one. I mean, we have hypotheses, but they're just what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it goes back to the fork analyzing the fork, right?
Right.
Now, it's very hard to accept that I've been raised in thinking that I am an individual, and I would even go further than that. I don't even think this is a cultural thing. I think it's an evolutionary mechanism. That, first of all, why is there an evolutionary mechanism? Because to survive, you need to be able to recognize units, right? If I want to survive and I need energy, I can't just go after a collective.
Mm-hmm.
And collectives, by the way, are a way to defend yourself. Some animals actually, they defend themselves by being a huge number,
right?
And then the predator doesn't know where to go, right? So the collectives become the defense mechanism. You've seen some of those documentary on animals, right?
Mm-hmm.
The lion there is like, where am I going, right? And you got all these animals running. So I think one of the survival mechanisms for units is to be able to recognize other units, right? And to be able to steal, quote unquote, steal their energy. Essentially, that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you need, on an evolutionary basis, you need to be able to distinguish or at least perceive units instead of perceiving wholes. I think the other reason is that it's a good fiction for us. Right? It makes the collective stronger
mm-hmm.
if units believe in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think they're not even cultural
right.
mechanism. I think they're more deep, and they're deeper than that. And even people will say, well, some cultures put more emphasis on the collective good than on the individual good. Yes, but people go and interview any of these people in any of these cultures, they'll still talk about themselves and their kids and their wife or their husband and and their life. So I think there's something very strong in there that's beyond culture, but I think it's a very good fiction to have us survive.
I remember in the 80s, friends at school started walking in a certain way when rap became popular.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a technology, right?
Yeah.
It's a form of technology.
It's very, that's a good point. Defining technology is almost impossible.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you see technology and you know what it is, right? You see a computer, you see a truck or a bus, and say, well, this is technology, but some of these technology are much, much more subtle than that, and they're much more intertwined with what we are. So what is it exactly? For a long time, we thought that technology was a mechanism that was non-organic. Essentially, that's what, it was a mechanism, and it was non-organic, and it couldn't reproduce itself, essentially, right? A hammer cannot reproduce itself. A pen mécanique,
a digger.
Yeah. This huge thing,
the
right?
Machine, the digger. It's called a digger.
Digger. It cannot reproduce itself, right? So we thought that was pretty simple until, again, we realized that viruses are like that, right? They're a mechanism and they can't reproduce themselves. They need something else to reproduce themselves. And some people have mentioned that they're not sure if viruses are alive or not, right? But they're organic and they're there and they have an influence and impact on life. But they're probably not alive. So they're machines, maybe.
I'm pretty stubborn. And I think I can't get away from the idea, this question, this critique, critique of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were just talking about the university off camera. And the university is itself a technology, and currently the university, I'm not sure about how it works in Quebec, but in BC it's increasingly neoliberal.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you do have the FTE system where bums in seats, You know, that sort of idea that the value of a class is the amount of students that are in it. And the performance of a professor is how many students the professor can teach. And so that's an increasingly neoliberal model. And neoliberalism is very interesting because, as Foucault, you know, is analyzing liberalism in his lectures on biopolitics, biopolitics as it starts to be discussed in the late 17th century and throughout the 18th century. And again, this is a reflection on how government occurs, but also a reflection happening whilst governing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
a lot of what he's doing, and it makes me think of this sort of self-reflexive project of liberalism. It's a change. It's part of the change of governance, is this reflexive process. And so universities are participating in this in a neoliberal way because they're constantly reflect, and it affects the nature of work, and it affects the status of the university, this reflection. And so it's inseparable from economic questions, and so everything is reduced to these economic questions, and so they do in some ways show that the economy is the principal decider, or this, to use George Bush's noun. And so I'm not sure how we can think about this role, this other life, because it takes its own life.
Yeah.
So to again, it's ambiguous, this idea of taking your own life, but also something becomes, it replicates itself.
Yeah.
So the whole neoliberal system replicates itself. Yep. And so I'm not sure, so we obey, we work, we work, that technology takes over.
Mm-hmm.
But the arch technology there seems to be the sort of neoliberal system. I don't know whether you agree with that or how you think.
Well, there's many, let me just talk about neoliberalism first, and then I'll talk about the university, because now I'm on the other side.
Yeah.
I can tell you about the point of view of administration. But anyway, let's talk about neoliberalism. I don't think it's the arch principle, I think it's one of the underlying principle. I think the principle is, again, and this I truly believe that, it's a principle. I think the ecosystem works on the principle of energy, meaning how much energy do you spend for how much energy you get, right? So it's essentially an economic way of looking at things. For example, we know that sometimes because you get a lot of rabbits on this campus, right? So I'll have an anecdote with that. We know that some of these rabbits are vignettes for the hare, right? When the hare is being chased by a fox, at one point, if the hare is at one point, the fox is another, and the hare knows that the distance is too long for the fox to reach him or her, it will rise up and say, "Here I am." So the hypothesis, because we're not in the hare's head, but the hypothesis is that the hare is saying to the fox, it's no use chasing me, because you're going to spend energy, I'm going to spend energy doing it, but you'll never catch me, so get away from it, right? And I think, well, again, this is our interpretation of it, but there's a lot of this, if you look at nature, there's a lot of this exchange of energy. Some of the intimidation that animals have between the males, you know, they'll try to intimidate one another because they don't want to spend the energy into fighting. Because the energy spent into fighting is too large. Is the energy, some of the evolutionary scientists have looked at peacocks, for example, and wonder how can a peacock have such a, you know, beautiful tail while it's spending a lot of energy, and they've calculated that actually the peacock is spending a lot of energy, but it's still worth it if you think that it's spreading its gene, the energy. So I think there's an economy of energy all through the system. And again, we do the same as individuals, right? We'll look at what's more efficient energy-wise and how much we spend our energy, and we'll go there. So is that neoliberalism?
Well, I think that's how Foucault says, that's exactly what he says right. happened, right? Yeah. There's this shift, it's yeah. a naturalization
yeah. Yeah.
of the political economy.
Yeah.
And but it's part of the discourse, and so it sort of replicates itself.
Yeah, it does replicate itself. The only thing that I am not, that I don't agree with, it's again, it's the scale of values, right? Mm-hmm. That neoliberalism by itself is dangerous. It is, right? There is some mm-hmm. of it that is dangerous. Now, two or three things here. First of all, I don't think it, my take on it is that, again, it doesn't, it's not a top-down kind of thing. It's a bottom-up kind of thing. We're all part of it, and we're all working it. And the discourse, I would say, is not a discourse that comes after. It's not a discourse that comes before. It's a discourse that comes after the actual structure of it. So I think it's part of what we are. Is it good or bad? Well, on an absolute scale, it doesn't have values. Now, that doesn't mean that, because we're human beings and we need some sort of moral standing to what we do, because if we don't have that, we have nothing, right? And we have chaos. To me, and your question is interesting, to me, the great challenge right now is knowing that these systems are all over, they're in our nature. Now, what do we do to create a discourse or create a position on these systems that will not make them absolutes on a value scale, but still will enable us to make them maybe less damageable, right? So they're not, because the problem with the discourse on neoliberalism, it says that some people are neoliberals and some are not, and these people are the bad ones and these people are the good ones, right? And I think it's spread all over in everything we do. Now the challenge is, do we create some sort of a moral standing on this? Do we have ethics on this? Should we have ethics on this, or let the world move as it does? I think we should have a moral standing, but we shouldn't transform the discourse because of the moral standing. It should, you know, the pressure between the actual system and our will to have a world that is better and more ethical, they should go hand in hand, and one should not be subsumed to the other. So, okay, that's my first. Does that answer your question?
No, I think it's ongoing, because I think it hits on some questions about art that might.
But let me answer yeah. first the university part, yeah. because it's an interesting one. Let me be a little cynical here.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
As a vice provost, continue learning.
This discourse about neoliberalism in the university, to me, is a false discourse. Mm-hmm. It is everywhere. Whenever you open University Affairs or the Chronicle, that's the first thing you always read, that the university is going into a neoliberalist model. Maybe in the States, I don't know. But in Canada, to me, it's a false discourse. First of all, because everything needs funds, right? So if you cannot have a university that is not, that doesn't have any funds, right? So money is the nail that I get. At one point, even though it's not pleasant, even though we think it's not the mission of the university, you still have to think about it, because you need to pay your professors, you need to pay graduate students, you need to have libraries and books and buildings, and all these things cost a lot of money. And I don't think university are, the discourse I hear, what I'm hearing from people, is not at all this model. It's just the model that we need funds to do what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And to be extremely cynical, I would say that professors hate the neoliberalist model until they're into the collective agreement negotiations. And then they usually say, you know, we're not paid the way the other professors are paid within the market, yeah. you know, within the yeah. So yeah. all I'm saying, and that goes back to, this is those are systems of energy, and they're everywhere. And professors will use them, and what I think professors are afraid of is that, and that's a completely different topic, but the university itself has changed so much in the last 200 years, even the last 50 years. I was reading that in Quebec, in the 1950s, there were 8,000 university students in all of Quebec. Right? Now, just in my Faculty of Arts and Science at Concordia, there's 15,000 of them. Right? So it's not the same structure anymore, right? We, instead of having, you know, 10,000 top students, we have in Quebec maybe 300,000 students, and some of them are not as good. But it means that the system has to grow, and we give services. When I was an undergraduate student, we didn't have services the way we have now for students. We didn't have counseling services and psychological services and medical services and all these things. We didn't have them, right? So we need to pay for these things. And I think a lot of universities are saying, they might not be saying only that how much is the professor costing. They look at that, of course. How many students are in class? They look at that, of course. But they will also look at how efficient are we in making sure the student gets a good education.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to balance that with anomalies.
Right.
When you see someone is having three students for the last 20 years, as an undergraduate class, you're saying there's an anomaly here.
But at the same time, I think these things get confused because in some ways it's as if the student determines what knowledge, the student decides what the student should learn.
There's some of that, yes.
And on the other hand, there's this idea, and I agree fully with Paul de Man here, that professors shouldn't be masters of rhetoric. And increasingly, there's these two dimensions. You have to teach what the students want to learn, and you have to teach in the way that the students want to learn. And that's not necessarily learning, and it's not necessarily teaching new things, and it's not pushing the limits of knowledge. And so often you have professors who are teaching new ideas, but they only have three students. And whereas the professors that teach what the students want to learn, you know, novels and so on, they have all the students. And so this is a tension, and it's driven by these forces of energy. They're memes, right? So so you're going to put out these memes because...
I agree. They're forces of energy, and now it's our turn to, you know, bring the balance here on the other hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because those are tension. Now, on the other hand, you can ask, because that's something that is important, that you can look at the way we've been teaching undergraduate students mostly in the last X number of years. And the last X number of years, I think a lot of it was based on the professor's performance, right? And course evaluation, you know, have a big role to play for that, because they're saying how good was the professor, right? Instead of saying, how much did you learn, actually, right? Even though the professor might not be the most exciting person in the world, you might have learned a lot of things, right? You might not be the most, you know, sexy person, but still is a good professor. So we're responsible for some of that. But also, I think there's accountability in teaching, not in research, but there's accountability in teaching that we need to face as professors. And we need to know that. We need to say to students, these are the outcomes I want you to reach. And this is how I'm going to assess if you're reaching them or not. And a lot of it, we've done it intuitively, but a lot of it we haven't done, right? So, yes, there is a pressure to teach what undergraduates want. And that's a whole shift in society where we put more emphasis on quote-unquote, and it's a word I hate, on the client. So there's a whole shift in society right now. Now it's our turn to say we don't agree with this, right? And it's our responsibility to do that. On the other hand, it's also a responsibility to say this, because we've never done that, this is what I think you should learn by the time you finish this course, graduate, you have your, you know, undergraduate diploma, graduate diploma. We don't do that. And we're even afraid of saying these are things I think you should have reached, because then it forces us to be accountable, saying, you know, have we done it or not? So, you know, there's problems on both sides, but I'm very hopeful, because we all realize that we need to, and it goes back to what we've been saying, the university, as you said, is a technology, is part of the system. It's one of the feeder to the system of what the human condition is, one of the biggest feeder for that, why the human condition is what sociology is, what politics, what art is, and the university now keeps feeding some of these classical notions to society, keeps, you know, pushing students into society with these classical notions. But some of the things you've raised show that there is tension within the university, and we feel this tension. And we feel things shifting, and we know we need to reinvent ourselves, right? But there's resistance with, but we feel it every day in the university, and that's a good thing.
I think there's parallels with art. And
yeah.
You know, I study Mallarmé, and for him the big problem in the 19th century was that literature was reduced to market forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so his aesthetics is not only pushing the limits of what can be done formally and aesthetically, but resisting. It's a form of resistance to what he called the high commerce of letters.
Yeah.
And so what's very interesting, though, on the other hand, is that, you know, so you have all this radical avant-garde art that pushes the limits and rejects the sort of capitalist model of art. and so is not very popular. It's on the margins. Mm-hmm. And Bourdieu has interestingly critiqued sort of some of these assumptions.
Yeah.
And recently, someone like Zizek will say, well, okay, but capital has adjusted itself and can recuperate these anomalies and quite efficiently and actually has transformed itself to be able to, so that these acts of resistance aren't acts of resistance anymore. There's this incredible ability to integrate things. And again, the center of the argument there from people like Zizek is definitely anti-capitalist. Although some people like Jacques Attali will say that, well, actually, capitalism itself works in favor of Marxism in the long term, mm-hmm. because capitalism itself will self-implode and so on, which he's sort of taking up from Marx, from some of his Marxist prophetic writings. I don't know how you see your art participating in that, because I think a lot of, for instance, La Condition Inhumaine, the inhuman continent, in some ways disrupts the way Google Earth functions, for instance. Yeah. So it sort of, to use a phrase that's been used about Simon Biggs, the digital poet, it creatively misuses something that's already there and shows and complexifies it. And so because the inhuman continent is so complicated, it actually in some ways is great, because because it's not working, it actually is working.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you could, in connection with these, all of these
are interesting. I think that makes me think what you just said too. You know, what William Gibson at one point said in one of his article, he said, it was in 1989 or 1990 or something, early 1990, he said, he was talking about tape recorders that were used to manipulate people, but that were, you know, used by counter-cultural people, especially in the ex-USSR. And he says a phrase that goes back to what you were saying, the street find its own uses for everything, right? So you get a technology and it'll be perverted one way or another by people. And to me, that this question about art and the resistance to it, I think it goes back again, because I tend to always bring down things to the same level. To me, it goes back to how biology resists pressures. So an infection, for example, spreads to a whole community, but there will always be pockets of resistance, and this pocket of resistance will eventually get rid of the infection. However, usually the infection goes into the actual physiology of the person who's resisting, right? Mm-hmm. Because they have a lesser strain of virus and they resist it, but they keep the virus within them, and then the virus is integrated, and then eventually you get another infection and another structure of resistance. And I think it works the same way for art and for the economy. I'm not afraid of the McDonaldization of the world. That doesn't worry me at all. I'm not afraid of the example people keep saying, you know, both of you are Anglophones, and people are saying, well, maybe you're in between, but
it's a good place to be.
Yes, but David, you're an Anglophone, and you know, people have been saying, well, you know, the worst threat to the general culture of humanity is English, the English language, because it's everywhere. Well, it's actually the most threatened language, because there are so many people everywhere speaking their own type of English that the actual English, the Shakespearean English, is the most threatened language in the world, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So, and I'm not afraid of these things. I'm not afraid. You look at music, pop music, how many times people are saying, you know, it's what's happening to music. And whenever these things happen, pockets of resistance just spring up, right? Everywhere. Okay. I'm not afraid of that. And art is the same way. You will always have this pressure of this, you know, this spread of contamination. You always have this spread of contamination, but there's a pocket of resistance, and then the spread will die down. The contamination will be recuperated within the system, and then another one will arise and resist, and things will move that way. So Mallarmé, he was avant-garde. Now he's part of this, part of the capitalist system essentially.
Could argue that he stole
marginal.
Still, but you know, he's not as not that marginal.
No, his name is important, but it's his poetry true. Is not read.
You're right.
He has, his name has a lot of currency. True.
You're right. But look,
got
look,
me a job.
But for example, the impression the impressionists, for example, are part now. They're really part of the Canada system, right? But other stuff are coming along, and they'll create this dynamic, and will change because of that. So, to me, the problem I see again with all of this discourse on politics is to me a value system. And I think we need to go beyond that. Mm. We need to see things differently. It's not that on the one hand you have all of the you know bad people, the Bushes and the Cheneys, and on the other hand you have all of these good people and this philosopher. I don't think it works that way. I don't think it works that way at all. I think it works in a much more complex way with other systems. And the world keeps adjusting to it. Now, that doesn't mean, because that's an argument that's been used by some of the neoliberalists to say, let the market forces decide on everything, right? And that doesn't work this way, because market forces are not left by, they're not left to themselves. They're usually helped a lot, a great deal by government, right? They get the most funding from government, yeah. Right? It doesn't work that way. But that's not what I'm saying, but I'm saying that let's see things in a different way as other let's put other grid analyses on these things to look at them differently. You know, and just if we're talking, I just need to tell you an anecdote. There was this beautiful, you know, image in the New Yorker. You know, they usually have great images. And I thought it was really funny, and I think it speaks to what you were saying. And it's Che Guevara,
mm-hmm.
And yeah. and he's got a Bart Simpson T-shirt. I thought that was beautiful. I thought it was just perfect. Right?
Yeah.
Related back to this notion of opening up departments and the liberalization of departments, that you see a really interesting trend in music departments, and this is me being cynical, but actually, as popular music is adopted, the cultural value of things like Mozart, people like mm-hmm. Mozart, things, cultural bodies like Mozart, Bach, actually increases, right? Because the students sense that now this has currency, right?
Yeah,
now that we've got 10,000 of us, I can study this. And so all of a sudden, it's no longer a sort of study of the figure mm. in this kind of ideal mm-hmm, language, right? Mm-hmm. It's a real currency.
You're right.
And so I can't remember the question that I was going to put with that, but...
You're talking about the pockets of resistance.
Right, pockets of resistance. And so I love this language of complexity, because even resistance gets resisted, right?
Yeah.
You know, you could, all of a sudden you could talk about Mozart as a pocket of resistance, which any composer of my disposition would say, well, wait a second, that's our territory here, in the academy. So it's an interesting way, and I wonder then, when you're talking about new ways of finding new ways to think about it outside of value. It really is a tremendous challenge, right?
Yes.
I mean, because the notions of time, space, and motion that we're using with respect to ideas just aren't going to cut it, I think.
But I think that the notion of values, and we've all fallen into that trap, is because they simplify the world.
Right.
Essentially, mm-hmm. right? And the left, the right, the center right, the center left, we all fell into that trap because they give a narrative on the world. And this narrative is simple. It's much more difficult to think about things in all sorts of different dynamics that move along the path of resistance, of least resistance. These are things that are hard to understand, and they're hard to visualize, right? It's much easier to visualize with good and bad. And so I think we're all guilty of that. And, you know, I'm also guilty of that because, as I was mentioning at the beginning, that's also the way I write, in a way, right? I have to simplify things, and I have to create a narrative, because that's the only way we understand things,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're losing something, and what I'm trying to say is that all of these political systems, all of these cultural systems are much more complex than what we believe. And I think Foucault and Bourdieu and all of these people and Deleuze, they had an inkling of that, right? And they mentioned it in their writing,
mm-hmm.
but there was still underneath that a scale of, you know, what's good and bad. There's
right.
a value there, right? There is. It's there. When you read Bourdieu, right? There is something about the system that imposes, and this imposition is negative, and it affects your self-determination. And Foucault, of course, with Power, does the same thing, and Deleuze also. So that's what I think they had a good idea, but we have to get beyond that, and a lot of people are still not able to do that, and a lot of governments are not able, and the university is not able to do that.
I'm very resistant to this idea of biological determinism, but mm-hmm. again, obviously, you're it's more nuanced than that because it's mm-hmm. also technological. Mm-hmm. It's symbiotechnological. So, in a sense, I like to believe that we have some sort of autonomy, that we can decide, that we can think separately and creatively outside of these forces, that we can create our own little separate island, you know, that can be separate from all of these forces. And so I guess so that we can be human.
Yeah.
Right? In the end, I think that's what we want, despite having been trained in deconstruction and all of that. I think that's a good point. That although I think increasingly Foucault towards the end is becoming more and more neutral. If you look at his lectures, it's very, very interesting. That value is not there. In fact, you could argue that he's a neoliberal.
Really?
Because that's how neutral he is. Okay. But although some people would. Their hair stand up to hear that, but I think it's very interesting to...
Lacan was a little bit like that also.
Well, that's right, there's this neutrality that you don't know, you don't really know where his values are.
But Lacan, he was sort of neutral, but on the other hand, he was still talking about, you know, domination, mm-hmm. dominating and dominated, and these things are part of the value system still, right? And I think we still need to go beyond these things. But at least, you know, at least they make, you know, to me, one of the most fundamental problem is the university itself, the academy, which is extremely resistant to change, strangely enough, right? You think that's where new ideas are fermented. Maybe new ideas, but moving people in another direction, there's this huge resistance to it, right? And it's funny because the university itself works like a neoliberal structure, if you want to say it, and when I'm talking about the university, I'm talking about the administration, but the whole community, professors, students, administration, where things just, you know, you have your power setting, you have your structure, this structure will not move because it's working, and it's protecting itself, and it's protecting its advantages, right? And you're trying to deconstruct some of it, and that won't work, and it's a strange, strange, strange phenomenon when you look at it.
Yeah. Well, that way, what you're doing is you're aligning change with neoliberalism and energy, because
I'm aligning change with energy, yes, not neoliberalism, because I think we've got to go beyond that.
But in some ways you can argue that neoliberalism is all about change and radical originality, and if Zizek's right,
I think we got to go beyond again that, because if you're telling me that, if you look again at biological determinism, which I believe in, and you don't believe it as much.
But
that's fine. That's fine. You know, if you look at it, it's not that. I think there's two pressures. There's two pressures in the ecosystem. One is to find the equilibrium always, and the other one is to be able to innovate so that you survive. So these two things are always together, and I think the equilibrium, I would say, if we want to make it very, if we want to simplify the whole thing, and that's really, it's a very great simplification, but the equilibrium will be mostly the left, and the pushing towards something else would be the right, but again, simplification, right? Mm-hmm. Because one talks about, the equilibrium talks about being able to find a more peaceful way of living, right? Even in the ecosystem, the equilibrium in prey and predators, right? The other way of looking at things is usually catastrophes or mutations or changes, and they're very violent and they're very difficult, and there's a lot of pain involved with that. That's how things are moving and going forward. And again, if we go beyond saying that one is the left, the other one is the right, I think we understand things a little bit better at that point. And we're all both part of it. And we, even our own private lives, we have both. We always tend to go towards the equilibrium. We want to have security mm-hmm. and peacefulness. But then, after a while, we need changes and we need innovation and we need violence. And I'm not talking about the physical violence, but we need, you know, personal, cognitive violence or cultural violence to go forward into other stuff.
I think
maybe that's a good place to
end. All right. It's a pleasure. Thank you. Nice to meet you.